For years, one of the safest things to do with money was put it into a savings account or a CD. Today, not so much. Yields are so low that savings stashed away in these accounts lose value to inflation. NPR's Uri Berliner has been watching some of his own savings dwindle. In a series we're calling Dollar for Dollar, he tries to put some of that money to work.
I decided to take $5,000 from savings to explore various types of investments. Believe me, there are plenty of them out there.
One of MoneyWeek's favorite investments is the exchange-traded fund.
And in this video, I want to talk to you about your journey as a real estate investor.
Silver actually makes the better investment.
Investors worldwide are creating a global stampede and investing their money in Brazil.
I never thought I'd be spending this much time in parking garages. But to invest in that area, you have to.
These kinds of pitches may not be your idea of fun, but to be a saver?
Oh, it's absolutely miserable.
That's Jacob Kierkegaard of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Since the financial crisis, savings accounts have offered a negative yield, another way of saying your money there shrivels, losing value to inflation. Kierkegaard says this is a freakish situation, last experienced during the Great Depression.
We haven't seen a sustained period where interest rates have been this negative for this long. This is a truly unprecedented situation.
When Kierkegaard says this negative, here's what he means. The average yield or interest rate on a savings account at a major bank is 0.1%, according to Bankrate.com. Inflation is running at 1.7%. Do the math there. It's a lousy deal for savers. For more than 4 years, the Federal Reserve has tried to revive the economy by getting credit flowing more energetically. In pursuit of that goal, the Fed has kept interest rates at nearly 0%. Kierkegaard says that's why yields are so skimpy on savings accounts.
So you can say that savers and the return that savers earn on their money is kind of a collateral damage in the crisis management conducted by the Federal Reserve and other central banks.
My wife and I have a kid in college, a mortgage, and I put money into my retirement plan. Anything left over goes into family savings. And yes, it's kind of frustrating to see that money chipped away by inflation. It's far worse for someone on a fixed income who pays for food, rent, and medical expenses out of savings. Now, I've got $5,000 to work with here, so I stopped in to see Nessa Fettes. She's a senior vice president at the American Bankers Association. I asked her to make the best case for the savings account.
Bank accounts are FDIC insured. That means that no matter what happens to the institution, if the bank fails, no matter what happens to the economy, the customer's money is safe, up to $250,000.
What else have you got?
There's a convenience to having a savings account in the same institution where the customer's checking account is.
Convenience and FDIC guarantees are fine, but with the Fed expected to keep record low rates for a while longer, there's not much hope those savings will grow. So I'm taking some of that money out and putting it to work. In the stock market?
They've got the U.S. Broad Market ETF, so that's also a very low expense ratio, and it includes everything in the U.S. market.
In bulk purchases at a discount store as a hedge against inflation.
Cash, if you can spare it to convert your cash into real goods whose price is rising, that's not a bad idea.
In what can broadly be defined as real estate.
I'm inside a 5x5 foot self-storage unit in Bethesda, Maryland.
Each of these investments has its own type of risk. They could lose value, but they could also come out ahead, which is something that can't be said now for the money I have parked in savings. Uri Berliner, NPR News.
Finally today, I'm still thinking about that massive Powerball jackpot last weekend. That caused me to think about what's wrong with Powerball. The most important thing, of course, being the fact that I didn't win. You know you feel the same way. I'm sure I would have been a good winner. Like Oprah, I would use my powers for good and not evil. Like, say, I might buy a Bentley out of the showroom window just to prove to myself that I could. But then I'd settle down and endow scholarships and fix up blighted storefronts and invest in local businesses. Seriously, I'd find all kinds of other good things to do. Actually, I don't know about the Bentley. I don't even know where they sell Bentleys. Do they even have a showroom? Maybe you have to order them online, or do they bring them to your house? Whatever. Look, what I'm saying is I would get the crazy out of my system before I settle down to do the right thing. which is why I'm thinking about Powerball and why I think it tells you many things about where we are as a country. Think about it. It turns out that the biggest jackpot in history, more than $500 million, had one winning ticket, the purchaser of which has wisely waited to come forward, presumably until he or she has figured out how to handle the parade of supplicants that is sure to come. And doesn't this precisely dovetail with the anxiety that many people have about the concentration of more and more wealth in fewer and fewer hands? Just over the past 2 weeks, we've reported on the fact that the Dow Jones Industrial Average has hit an historic high. At the same time, there are fewer Americans in the stock market than at any time since Gallup started asking the question 15 years ago. We've also reported on the fact that more and more investors are buying up all those foreclosed homes, in many cases beating out individual homeowners who cannot pay cash or don't have the pristine credit needed to get a mortgage under today's very high standards. We won't know for some time whether these changes will be, in the long run, better or worse to raise the bar for participation in today's economy, to demand more and more education, to make it harder to buy a home rather than rent, for example. But we do know that many people feel left out and are left out right now. And we do know that many people feel the country just isn't working for them, that somebody's got the winning ticket, but they don't know who, and they know it isn't them. But here's where Powerball shows us what's right. Americans still dream. It must have been a local news staple, it sure was where I live, to show the people lining up for their tickets, smiling as they bought them, and telling the reporters what they would do with the money if they won. And an awful lot of people said they would pay off bills, help out family, give to charity, do something good. Here's the funny thing. Americans are doing that anyway, without Powerball. Did you know that the One Fund, created to help out victims and their families after the Boston Marathon bombing, has already raised more than $31 million? The first millions were raised in a matter of days. Remember the school bus monitor who got picked on by her middle school charges? More than $700,000 was raised for her in a matter of days. And let's not forget the millions for earthquake relief after Haiti and the money people give on sites like Kickstarter and Donors Choose to make demos, finish TV pilots and other art projects, and to fund projects in classrooms around the country. The point is that Americans still dream big and are willing to do big things and small things to help each other out. So it makes you wonder, why as a country are we so stuck on so many things that we all know need fixing? One of my guests recently reminded me of Winston Churchill's famous quote, I'm paraphrasing, Americans will always do the right thing once they've tried everything else. Maybe that's another way of saying we have to get the crazy out of our system before we settle down. So who's going to buy the country at Bentley? Hey, Powerball winner, want to volunteer? And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. Nearly 20 states have now legalized marijuana, mostly for medical use, though in some cases for recreational use. And strange things happen when one state brings an underground market into the mainstream and another doesn't. It turns out marijuana dealers who suddenly find their business legal often find themselves making less money, so some hit the road. Reporter Marianne McCune of WNYC and our Planet Money team has the story of one California dealer who went to New York for higher profits and the special agent he left behind.
Greetings from the front lines of the assault on sobriety.
This is Chuck. That's what he wants to be called. He's a San Francisco pot dealer.
Welcome to the war on drugs.
But we're going
to
make him sound like this.
I'm happy to report that drugs is winning.
Maybe more like this.
You're tuned to WNYC, bourgeois assimilationists.
Okay, the point is we've agreed to change this guy's voice, and here's where we've settled.
Hi, we're helping keeping people stoned on a Friday in New York City. Oh, there's my phone ringing.
Chuck came to New York from California to sell weed because here in New York, where his trade is 100% illegal, he can make more money. He spends pretty much every day dealing what he calls farm-to-table marijuana.
What else do I need?
To get ready, we step into the bedroom.
This is it. A pile of clothes, a pile of weed, a bed to sleep on.
He puts the pile of weed into a backpack, and we head to the subway.
Hey, before we go, can you tell me how much you're carrying?
I don't know, but I'm going to guess 6 ounces.
That's about $3,000 worth. If police could nail him for selling just what he has on him right now, he could go to prison. On the way down to the subway platform, we pass right by a cop.
I just stroll past nonchalantly.
This danger of being caught and jailed, Chuck is choosing this risk. He left a state where he could have sold marijuana in a storefront and came to a state where he has to deal under the table. In this case, literally, right here in a downtown diner, one of our first stops, he passes a baggie under the table to a client who folds his cash into the pages of a book and passes it back. Welcome to the contradictory-seeming economics of the nation's fast-changing marijuana laws. The rise of medical marijuana in California is, strangely enough, what drove Chuck to New York. And here's why. Since the state of California made medical marijuana legal 17 years ago, hundreds of dispensaries have opened up. With the rise of the dispensaries, illegal dealers like Chuck, they lose customers. Too much competition. And it's competition with a serious edge. Not only can the dispensaries advertise and operate in broad daylight, their customers don't have to break the law every time they score. And in California, almost anyone can get a prescription.
People who retail weed the old-fashioned way, like myself, I saw my business falling off. So my idea was, okay, why not move to New York, where I would probably have success?
Chuck said, I'll buy in California and I'll sell it to New Yorkers. A good plan, because New Yorkers will pay $60 or more for an 1/8 ounce of the stuff he sells, compared to $45 or much less in California. But then came the next challenge, how to get the weed from California to New York, how to get it past people like Special Agent Roy Georgie. I usually catch Georgie on his cell, driving through the foothills of the Sierras with the radio on.
Can you hear the music?
Georgie is with the California Department of Justice, and he and the other guys on his task force spend their time trying to catch and arrest illegal growers and dealers.
We're actually arresting people that are shipping it all over the country.
One easy place to look: the FedEx or UPS in, say, Humboldt or Mendocino counties, California's pot country. Georgie and his guys will stop by and sort through all the outgoing packages looking for marijuana.
And we'll spend 1 hour out there and identify 30 parcels.
And that's looking at how many parcels total?
I don't know the exact percentage, but about one out of every 15 going by is a good one.
That's amazing.
And it is. It really is. And it's an eye-opener. You know, I got to put the phone down for 1 second. Hold on.
California weed has been flowing east for decades. What's new, Georgie says, is all the would-be medical marijuana heading out of state. It's what Georgie calls the white boy ranch grows. Thousands of small pot farmers with permits to grow legally for themselves and the dispensaries, but who still choose to sell on the black market. The same economic forces that drove Chuck out of California are driving growers to ship their crops east as well.
That's a whole other side now, and that's where the eastern states are getting impacted.
Basically, with the rise of medical marijuana came a rush of pot farmers. With the rush of pot farmers came a glut of supply, and with the glut of supply, wholesale prices plummeted. Some growers haven't been able to unload all their crops at the price they want on the local legal market, so why not send it out of state to where it's less a commodity and more of a brand with clout?
Right now, Northern California bud, that trademark, that stamp, is really some of the best in the world.
You should smell this stuff. Really super citrusy.
With customers, Chuck can talk about marijuana like it's a fine California wine.
Tangerine.
When he pours out the contents of his backpack to reveal the broad range of flavors that marijuana dispensaries have helped to popularize, his clients are wowed.
It's all from California.
The combination of Chuck's old-school authenticity and boutique product, not to mention his dependable service, it's an alluring package to the class of New Yorkers he serves. One guy asks, "Are you a delivery service?" Chuck explains he's more of a mom-and-pop shop.
You better, man. I'd love to become a client.
Chuck's move to New York, his wager on a city with no marijuana dispensaries but a taste for California's finest. So far, it's paying off. He says he's quadrupled his income since he moved here. And there's one more reason Chuck's business is doing so well. It's because the people who are working to stop him are at the same time giving his business a boost.
I may lose you. I'm going over some mountains here.
Special Agent Roy Georgie is now on his way back from a remote part of the mountains where he was lying quietly in a creek, spying on a couple farmers planting marijuana on public land.
Yeah, kind of a miserable cold morning, but well worth it. We got some great footage.
What did you see?
We had three Hispanic gentlemen. Two are wearing camouflage.
Georgie and his task force, they work night and day to catch anyone growing or selling marijuana underground, whether it's Mexicans growing on public land, Asians growing hydroponically, or the white boy ranchers selling would-be medicine on the black market. But all that work Georgie and law enforcement across the country do to catch the bad guys, to disrupt the illegal flow of marijuana, if they don't manage to find Chuck, they're actually helping him. Because the harder they work to stop him, the riskier it is to do his job. And that means Chuck has fewer competitors. He can charge higher prices. Here he is counting a fat wad of bills.
Sorry about this. In white Protestant culture, it's considered to be gauche to flash giant wads of money in front of guests. But we'll just do it anyway.
There is one more advantage of working in an illegal market. The competitors Chuck does have are kind of hard for his customers to find.
There's plenty of weed in New York. There is just an illusion of scarcity, which is part of what I'm capitalizing on.
What do you mean?
Because this is a black market business, there's insufficient information for customers.
In economics, it's called information asymmetry. If weed were legal, Chuck's customers could comparison shop. As it is, once they find Chuck, they're likely to stick with him. So, Special Agent Roy Georgie and Chuck. On the surface, they're enemies. But in a way, these two guys can't succeed without each other. Georgie is in some small part inflating Chuck's profits. Chuck, he's helping to keep Georgie employed. Why do you do what you do?
Wow. I think it's really the overall love for the job. If we weren't working the level we were working, it would spread from what's going on in Mexico up into California. It's very self-rewarding. It kind of becomes your high. Tomorrow will be better.
Can I call you then? Okay, if every law enforcement agent across the country were as aggressive as Georgie and his guys, if they could check every tractor trailer, every Greyhound bus, every suitcase and cardboard box, Chuck would be out of business. But as things stand, there's just enough law enforcement to weed out the competition and not enough to scare Chuck away.
I'm going to guess the law enforcement priorities that I'm not near the top.
Chuck makes dealing weed look so easy. Before I leave him to finish his deliveries on his own, he takes a risk he says he rarely does. He's about to meet up with a couple regular customers, but he can't figure out where to do the deal. So he just does it right there on the street, in plain view.
Yes, here we'll have to do.
A neighboring building super puts out the recycling and watches suspiciously from a few feet away.
You all right?
And Chuck walks away with $400 more. That's what he's here for.
All right, bye.
Marianne McCune, NPR News, New York.
Support for Planet Money comes from Lincoln Financial Group. For over 100 years, working to help Americans take charge of their futures and become their own chief life officers.
For those who closely follow decisions made by the Federal Reserve, today's marquee event was the testimony of Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke. He appeared on Capitol Hill before the Joint Economic Committee of Congress. And some lawmakers asked Bernanke about concerns of chaos in the financial markets once the Fed stops pumping money into the economy. NPR's John Itzty explains.
Let's first step back and consider what the Fed's been doing to try to boost growth in the past 5 years. They've injected a huge amount of money into the economy by buying government bonds and mortgage-backed securities, around $2 trillion worth. That amount grows each month at the rate of $85 billion as the Fed continues its purchases. The Fed's action has driven interest rates down and made vast amounts of cheap cash available. Investors have pushed a lot of that cash into the stock market, which has climbed sharply. Some people are worried it's created a stock bubble. Dan Coats, a Republican congressman from Indiana, is one of them. He shared his concern with Chairman Bernanke today.
There's a big surge in the market here that seems to be not enforced by underlying fundamentals, but I'd like your take on that.
Well, we're watching it carefully, and of course nobody can ever say with certainty what an asset price should be. But to this point, our sense is that major asset prices like stock prices and corporate bond prices are not inconsistent with the fundamentals.
So Bernanke's watching, but not too worried. What happens, though, when the Fed decides the economy needs less help and it starts trimming back its $85 billion in monthly purchases? Minutes of the Fed's last meeting 3 weeks ago show policymakers are discussing tapering off those purchases. That would cut back on the fuel supply for the economy and the market. Today, Representative Kevin Brady, a Republican from Texas, asked Bernanke when the tapering will begin.
At the pace we're going, do you think it's likely these actions will begin before Labor Day?
I don't know. It's going to depend on the data. If the outlook for the labor market improves and we are convinced that that is sustainable, we will respond to that. If the recovery were to falter, then we would delay that process.
The chairman said the timing would be discussed at the Fed's next few meetings. Now, the stock market fell today as investors got nervous even at the suggestion that the fuel that's helped propel the market might be slowing. But the real doomsday scenario for the market comes when the Fed decides not just to slow the flow of fuel, but starts draining fuel out of the tank. That process would involve the Fed reversing course and selling off its $2 trillion hoard of securities. That was part of the Fed's initial strategy for exiting its stimulative policy. But today, Bernanke said maybe not.
At this point, it does not appear that it is necessary for us to sell any assets, or particularly not any mortgage-backed securities, in order to exit. And I think there's some advantages to doing that.
Rather than sell the assets, the Fed will just hold on to them until they mature. One big advantage, Bernanke says, less disruption for the markets. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.